Once a month, regular listeners will know we have Dr. Zoe Harcombe, our diet expert, on the show. And today it couldn't be better because Zoe's got a brand new book out called The Diet Fix. So we're going to talk about that. Morning, Zoe!
Good morning, Bill. How are you doing?
Good. Lovely to talk to you. And how brilliant that... How many books have you written now, then?
Oh, crikey. I should have been prepared for that question, shouldn't I?
is that many you've forgotten?
Yeah, sort of. 2004 was the first one.
Wow.
It came out in 2008. 2010 was a really big one, 2011, two in 2013.
Wow.
And then I haven't written one for ages because I was then doing a PhD. So
yes.
That knocked me out from end of 2012 until early 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think I was going to write another one, actually, but I had a lovely approach from, I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Michael Mosley.
Oh, absolutely. He's just, in fact, brought his own new one out, hasn't he?
Exactly, yeah. So we're with the same publisher now, actually.
Ah!
So I had a lovely approach from them about this time last year. I didn't realise we'd be competing against each other in the January charts.
Actually, it's good you mention him because he's one of the other... I mean, you know that I love what you do and the way you talk about stuff. And Michael Mosley is quite similar in the way he approaches the world of medicine.
He's very similar in that we're both fans of real food.
Yeah.
And we're both not fans of junk food and we're definitely not fans of starchy carbohydrates. Where we differ is that he's still very much a fan of eating less.
Mm-hmm.
And his current book that's out at the moment is about eating 800 calories a day.
Yes.
Which is my idea of hell on earth, if I am allowed to say that. I think I've probably eaten that already, actually. It's about 10:30
here in the
UK.
Oh, funny.
I just can't eat that little.
Mm.
And how men eat that little, I just don't know. But it can be very effective, but as I share in this book, it can also go back on as quickly as it comes off.
That's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the point of this is, Zoe, and people who've heard you before will know this, that this is not something that you just said to yourself, oh, do you know what, I'll just rattle off a quick diet book and make a few quid. This is what you do for a living, the science of this.
It is, yeah. And if anyone knew the economics of publishing, nobody would ever think that anyone writes a book to make money. So... If I worked out my hourly rate, this book does pretty well, if I work out my hourly rate, it's going to be embarrassing.
Oh, bless.
But authors are lucky if they make 50p a copy, and books are lucky if they sell more than 2,000 copies. So
incredible.
You don't have to be good at maths to work that one out.
No, absolutely.
Unless you're J.K. Rowling, who does make a good income. But I think a lot of that, actually, is from the paraphernalia and the extras.
I'm sure it is. Yeah.
Yeah, writing it tends to make Amazon a lot of money, but it tends not to make the author a lot of money.
Yes.
So, a lot of the reasons why I write things is that I enjoy writing, it's what I do,
yeah.
And I do want to get information out there, and I get emails quite regularly where people will say, I came across your book, and it might have been anywhere in a magazine or in a library or at a friend's, and they just happen to come across it, and they write a lovely email saying, you've completely changed my relationship with food, and I'd like to thank you for that.
Wow.
And every one of those is worth whatever they could pay you.
Absolutely.
In royalties. So it's just lovely for me when... I remember one of the first messages I ever got, somebody wrote to me after Why Do You Overeat came out, which was back in 2004, and she said, where were you when I was at college stuffing my face and being utterly miserable? And I said, I was doing exactly the same. I just then thought I should write about it afterwards. So I've been there and got the T-shirt as well, which I think helps me relate to people who are going through this.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because, you know, it's part of what your motivation for this book, that you have been through the misery of what we would call yo-yo dieting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what I would call food addiction. So I do get very, very annoyed when people try to deny the existence of food addiction because I've experienced it.
Mm.
And if you look at food addiction, I describe it as a four-stage process. So number one, you want a quite particular thing. Let's say it's chocolate. So you feel quite addicted to chocolate. We never feel addicted to salmon or lamb or green beans or anything healthy, and there is a reason for that.
Mm.
So you start off wanting chocolate, then you want more and more chocolate. That's stage two addiction. Then you actually start to feel bad if you don't have chocolate.
Mm.
So people who've realized that they're eating too much of something and try to give it up will actually notice that they feel crabby and irritable, they crave it, they just don't feel their usual self. That's stage three addiction. And stage four addiction, which is unfortunately the stage that we get to, and that's the first stage that makes us do something about it, is when we suffer the consequences of that addiction.
Yeah.
So particularly with food addiction, the consequences are obesity, bloating, bad tummy, carb, puffy face, can be type 2 diabetes, which is when it starts getting a far more serious consequence of the addiction. But most of us only do something at stage four because, let's face it, if there were no consequences of eating junk food all day long, we would all do it.
Mm.
The only thing that would stop us would be what could we afford.
Mm.
But trust me, if I didn't get fat or didn't get sick from eating junk all day long, I would not choose healthy food. I'd have croissants and chocolate on them for breakfast. I'd have hot chocolate mid-morning, probably a muffin. I'd have sandwiches for lunch and a bag of crisps, fizzy drink, meal deal. I'd eat junk all day long. Why would you not? It's convenient. It's cheap quite often. And it tastes fabulous.
Yeah.
It's designed to taste fabulous because it's designed to taste completely unnatural, like nothing we've ever tasted before.
And so the premise behind this book then is to make the diet stick this time, make it different. And that's the point of it. You mentioned there at the beginning, it's January, people go on diets, and by February they've given up, they can't be bothered, that was a resolution gone. But this, you're trying to explain the science of this to people to make sense.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to say, fix it one last time. Don't go on a diet and then lose a bit of weight, regain it, and then a little bit more, and then go on another diet, lose, regain, and a little bit more. You've got to break out of that cycle. You've got to try something different. Eat less, do more hasn't worked for you. If it had, you wouldn't be buying this book or wouldn't be looking for another diet book or another diet in January. Mm. You have to fix the way you're eating. You have to eat differently. And one of the most important things then is to understand what it is that elicits weight loss, because it's not simply eating less or doing more, because the body can just adjust.
Yeah.
And that's the bit that people just don't seem to realize. They think, oh, I'll just eat a bit less, and then the body is in some miraculous way a cash machine for fat. The body will just say, oh, you've got 500 calorie deficit. There you go. I'm going to give you 500 calories off your love handles. If only it worked in that way. We wouldn't have a single obese person, let alone an obesity epidemic. We would just do that. But the body doesn't adjust in that way. So then you start looking at weight loss really, really differently. And you say, well, what actually is weight loss? And body fat is a structure called triglyceride. Tri usually means three, as in tripod, tricycle, all that kind of thing. And that is three fats joined together on a black backbone of something called glycerol. And as soon as you hear glyce, start thinking carbohydrate, as in glycemic and glucose and all that kind of thing. So it's essentially three fats joined together on a backbone of what is essentially glucose.
And this is one of the things, triglycerides, that they always bang on about alongside cholesterol, is once you've
got... Yeah, that gets confusing then, because Dr. Malcolm Kendrick, you've got to have him on soon, because he's also got a fabulous new book out called The Statin Nation.
And
Malcolm will go through the fact that triglyceride in the blood is actually one of those lipoproteins, and it's the lipoprotein called very low density lipoprotein,
right,
which is VLDL.
Yes.
So he will actually say, don't get confused between body fat,
right,
triglyceride, and VLDL, which is also unhelpfully called triglyceride. And VLDLs carry triglycerides, but they're not carrying body fat, they're carrying triglycerides from the food that we eat. So it gets really, really confusing. Think of body fat as a structure that is one part glycerol, three parts fatty acid, and it has to be broken down. So then you ask yourself, if you're a scientist and a curious type of mathematician as I am, under what circumstances will the body break down body fat?
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, you have to not have glucose available as fuel. And that's either glucose readily available in the bloodstream or glucose in your storage rooms. And we store glucose as something called glycogen. So you have to have those effectively running fairly empty for the body to say, okay, I now need to go and look for some body fat to break down.
Mm-hmm.
And under what circumstances will stored glucose be quite low, in the circumstances where you don't typically eat too much carbohydrate?
Okay.
So that's your first thing that has to be there. The second thing is you mustn't have insulin present. Because to break down body fat, there's a hormone that does this called glucagon. And glucagon is not out to play when insulin is out to play. So you will not break down body fat in any circumstances. It doesn't matter how your calorie deficit is going. You will not break down glucagon if you have insulin sloshing around in the body at that time. It's just physiologically impossible.
Interesting.
So what else do you have to do to not have insulin present? Insulin is typically present when we eat carbohydrates. So again, you start getting the message, don't eat carbohydrate too much, don't eat carbohydrate too often, because every time you eat carbohydrate, too much or too often, you've got insulin sloshing around, you are not going to be burning body fat.
Interesting. Okay, now, I'm not being stupid here, but describe exactly what you mean by carbohydrate.
Yes, so carbohydrate is in most foods, certainly most of starchy foods. It's not available in meat, fish, eggs, the most nutrient-dense foods, but it's in most of the foods that vegetarians would eat, in fact, practically all the foods that vegetarians would eat.
Mm.
So it's in things that come from the trees and things that come from ground. So it's in fruits, vegetables, legumes, as they're called, beans, pulses, potatoes, starchy carbohydrates, rice, pasta, the things that we're told to base our meals on.
Wow. So basically a lot of those things that we're told are really, really good for us.
Yeah. So the government telling us to base our meals on starchy foods, to eat little and often, to have our five a day in the forms of fruits and vegetables, to have breakfast and then snack, and then have lunch and then snack, and then have dinner, and then you probably need something before you go to bed, according to our dear government. They are putting us, in my view, in a permanent state of fat storage and an impossible state of fat breakdown. I honestly don't know at what point, if you follow the typical government dietary advice, would you ever get into the physiological state where you could break down body fat, let alone would you? I just don't know when it happens.
Good grief. Wow. So if we avoid those things, what do we replace them with then, Zoe?
Yep, so if we avoid the starchy carbohydrates, we would replace them with the most nutrient-dense foods, which are meat and fish and eggs. Dairy foods start to have a carbohydrate content, particularly fluid dairy. So when you move into things like milk and yogurt, you can be racking up something like 5 to 10% as a carbohydrate content, but that is still nothing compared to those starchy carbohydrates, which can be 70 to 90% starchy carbohydrates, depending on the cooking state.
And how do you get on then if you're a vegetarian or a vegan?
Okay, vegetarians, your best food options would be cheese and eggs.
Really? All the things we're told not to eat again?
Yeah, absolutely. But then it's because you've got the lower carbohydrate content. Eggs are virtually carbohydrate-free. There's a trace of carbohydrate in eggs. You can practically ignore it. Dairy, as we've said, things like hard dairy, the things that they most tell us to avoid because the fat content in the hard dairy is highest. You can understand why this is, because remember we've had conversations before saying there's only three things that you eat: carbohydrate, fat, and protein.
Yeah.
Protein is in everything other than sucrose, which is a pure carb, and oils, which are pure fats. So the two macronutrients that tend to vary are fat and carbohydrate.
Yeah.
So if you end up with a dairy food that's very high in fat, which is your hard cheese, it just so happens to be practically negligible in carbohydrate.
Good grief.
And when you get to the dairy that's higher in carbohydrate, like the milk and yogurt, that will be lower in fat than the hard cheese. So you're always playing with that carb-fat trade-off.
Right.
So when the government is telling us to go low-fat, they're telling us to go high-carb. And when I'm suggesting that we go much more managed in carbohydrate, I'm also suggesting that you go much more liberal in terms of fat. Don't fear fat, particularly when it comes with natural food. I'm not saying add coconut oil to coffee or anything daft like that, but I am saying if you've got a natural piece of meat or naturally oily fish or natural dairy produce, embrace it. Don't fear the fat that comes in natural food. Nature put it there to provide essential fats and fat-soluble vitamins. It didn't put it there to kill us.
And the word natural is the crucial point of that sentence, isn't it?
Yeah, natural, real food. So I'm not talking fake foods or unnaturally low-fat products or unnaturally high-protein products, just things that are naturally provided around us. And Spain, like the UK, has got some fantastic, real, natural food indigenous to the local diet.
Yeah.
We should be eating lamb over here in Wales, and you guys should be eating fish, particularly on the coast.
Yeah.
And whatever local animals, it's probably higher in pork in Spain than it is in ruminants or lambs, because the climate is just more conducive to those animals. Vegans, it's really, really difficult, because every single thing that a vegan eats, other than a pure oil, would have a carbohydrate content. So we do get vegans approaching us. We've got an online diet club, and we'll have vegans say, can we join, and would this be a good diet to follow? And we have to be honest and say, it's not, because we're trying to get you to watch your carbohydrate intake.
Right.
And essentially that's then limiting even the limited things that you choose to eat. And so it's not a good idea for you. If you want to be vegan, then embrace every single option that is available to you as a vegan from the real food palette. Please don't start going down this vegan sausage roll route and
the oh, that's the Greg thing, isn't it? That this week,
don't have fake food. Full stop. It doesn't matter if you're a carnivore or an omnivore or a vegetarian or a vegan. Don't have fake food in your diet. It's not going to do you any good whatsoever. It's just not healthy. It's not a great way to eat.
And what about sugar, Zoe? Where does that come into this?
Avoid the added sugars, certainly, because they're in fake food. So you would naturally be doing that if you're avoiding fake food. But then because we're not saying liberally eat fruit and certainly not saying five a day, then even natural sugar is limited within the way that I advise people to eat, because fruit at the end of the day is just sugar.
Right.
When you look at the sugar content of a very sugary food, for example, a banana, which I saw at the end of the year, is still of the one of the most popular fruits in the British diet, you can be racking up something like 4.5 teaspoons of sugar
really?
In a banana. Yeah, they are so sugary.
Good grief.
Yeah, I had one the other day because one came in the veggie box. We get a veggie box from the organic village. And a banana came in. I thought, God, I haven't had a banana for ages. Absolutely scrumptious, but as sweet as anything I taste at the moment. My diet just isn't that sweet. I eat very dark chocolate. 85%, it's delicious, but it doesn't taste sweet. A cherry tomato blows the roof of my mouth off now because I've just retrained my palate to not embrace sweet stuff.
Good grief. You see, that's we are so confused by the government and the press on this that all these fruit. I imagine if I ate fruit all day, I'd be the healthiest man in the world.
No, you'd be getting a heck of a lot of sugar. You might crave more sugar. Your blood glucose levels would be absolutely all over the place. Because remember, you only ever have 4 grams of glucose in your bloodstream at any one time, which is 1 teaspoon. So have that banana and it's knocked you 4 times over the limit. So then the body releases insulin. It tries to get all of that glucose out of the bloodstream because glucose in the bloodstream is catastrophic to the body.
Yeah.
It's a highly dangerous state. The body doesn't care that it came from a banana or a small bag of rubbish sweets.
Yeah.
The body just registers that you've chucked a shed load of glucose into the bloodstream and it has to deal with it. And of course, while the insulin is running around dealing with this catastrophic situation, there is no glucagon running around breaking down body fat. You are not losing weight. You might have eaten that banana thinking it was super healthy, but every time you eat anything containing carbohydrate, just visualize in your mind that you flicked off your fat burning switch. You flicked off any chance you had of losing body weight in that exact moment. Mm-hmm. How long that lasts for depends how long it takes to get the glucose out of your system, packed away, and to get your blood system back into a normal non-crisis state.
And what about, Zoe, if you're one of these people who are very athletic, so you go running every day or, you know, you go to the gym every day, should you be doing a different diet then? Should you be taking lots of carbs?
Well, good question, because some people do find that they don't fare terribly well on a very low carbohydrate diet if they're doing a lot of exercise.
Right.
And particularly, for example, if they're doing some very intense cardio workout, some people might feel quite faint if they haven't fueled that activity. Because what essentially happens is that the body will run around looking for glucose to use up, so it will take any out of the bloodstream and then it will start trying to put some back into the bloodstream. So it will go to the glycogen storage room, chuck as much back into the bloodstream as it can. Let's say you're relatively low in carbohydrate. It might, on quite an intense workout, or people run marathons or go for quite long runs, long cycle rides, it is quite possible that it would empty out your glucose stores.
Right.
And the body then is perfectly capable of fueling on body fat. But if you're not what we call fat adapted, then you have a bit of a crash. So you'll be familiar with this. You'll have heard long distance runners or even people just running 10K. They'll say, I hit the wall.
Yeah.
Or somebody will be doing an exercise class and they'll say, I just bonked. I crashed. I hit this moment. What they're actually describing is the exact moment when the body ran out of carbohydrate in the storage rooms. To all intents and purposes, the body never completely empties, but it will get to the point where it will say, right, there's no more to fuel this workout. Now I need to go and look for body fat. Now, somebody who's fat adapted, because they've learned to do this, and brilliant physiologists such as Professor Steve Finney, Professor Jeff Bollock, they've devoted their life to looking at the impact of food, nutrition on exercise, done brilliant controlled experiments in labs, and they would say that it would probably take about 3 to 6 weeks, maybe a bit longer if you're unlucky, to become fat adapted.
Uh-huh.
So you can then work out fueling on fat, and arguably your workout performance will get even better than it ever was before, because you don't have that crash. It suddenly becomes seamless.
Yes.
Now, my brother-in-law has actually done this. So my brother-in-law runs ultramarathons in New Zealand. So he does it up and down mountainous ranges. My brother-in-law in 2017 actually ran the coastline of Wales, which is 1,700 kilometres. He did it for charity. He did it for mental health. So we're very, very proud of him. Arguably, you have to have been a bit mad to take on that kind of challenge in the first place. But he did it in 26 days, and the previous record was 40 days. So he knocked 14 days, and he fueled on fat.
Mm.
And there's actually a blog on my site, Fueling on Fat, and it's all about my brother-in-law's run around Wales. And he was only able to do that because he was fat-adapted.
Right.
Now, he used to carb load. He used to fuel his runs on carbohydrate. And then he realized very soon into the run he was needing to eat those glucose gels and chocolate bars and try to fuel his run in really unhealthy, unnatural, horrible ways. And he was constantly lurching from one energy peak to one energy low, feeling nauseous, trying to cram these gels down into his mouth when he's running 50K. Felt so ill. And then he read the work of Professor Tim Noakes about becoming fat adapted, and he trained to become fat adapted, and he posts better times now than he has ever posted in his life.
Good grief.
And he's beating people for running times half his age because they're carb loading and he's fat adapted.
Wow.
So it's fascinating. You can get there and you will probably perform better than you have ever performed in your life, but you're going to go through a little bit of a transition period where you're going to feel a bit rubbish for a few weeks. I'll be really honest. And don't do it just before the London Marathon, but do it before the next marathon. Give yourself time and you'll never look back.
Zoe, as always, you have explained things in such a brilliant way. It's the first time actually anybody's explained how it all works in terms of the body and the glucose and all the rest of it to me that's actually made any sense to me. I totally understood what you just said. And for years, I've been like, oh, God, I've no idea what these people are banging on about now, whether I should be having this or that or that or this. Or so it's all in the book, which is out now. It's called The Diet Fix. And people can go to our website, tre.radio. And it's on our little bookstore there to save them trying to find it. No worries at all. Just makes it easier for people. Zoe, as always, pleasure to talk to you. You go off and have your chocolate bars and bananas. No, of course you're not.
I will. I'm off to have a cappuccino, actually. It's the middle of the day for me. I get up so early. This is definitely cappuccino time.
Oh,
so
bless you.
I'm off to have a good one.
Oh, lovely to talk to you again. We'll see you again in a month's time.
Thank you.
Take care,
Thanks
Zoe.
So
all the best. Bye. Cheers. Bye.